We trust doctors. We go to them at our most vulnerable times and expect them to have our best interest in mind. But what happens when they don't? Dr. Christopher Dunch was a spinal surgeon that left a trail of pain and death in his wake. Why was he able to continue operating after maliciously injuring so many people? Are we really as safe on the operating table as we are led to believe? This is True Crimecast.
This is True Crimecast, and we are so happy that you're here with us. I'm Jamie, here with John. What's good, man?
Hey, man. Tennessee did a little bit better than Kentucky this week, so it's been a great week so far, great weekend, and happy to be in the studio with you.
By a little bit better, you mean they didn't lose because they are on bye week, right?
Precisely.
Excellent.
Exactly.
Excellent. John, it's been a good week for True Crimecast. We've gotten several new Patreon supporters. We've gotten a few new five-star reviews on iTunes. We want to thank Cheyenne, Matri Mama, and Nasa May for your reviews. John, who are our Patreon members?
Jamie, I'd like to really thank Kathy, Megan, Samantha, and Amy for all their support over on Patreon. It's been a great week over there. So, you know, a few weeks ago I said we didn't have very many people at all over there, and now we have starting to get a little following, so it's been awesome.
Yeah, we'd appreciate you. If you're a follower of the podcast, to write a review or a rating on iTunes. If you would like to contribute to the show, as we've said before, we have full-time jobs. We're not looking to get rich off of this, but if we get some Patreon support, we can get better equipment and continue to improve the product.
Yep. Thank you guys so much for all your support. If you cannot physically contribute financially, then just leaving a rating and a review would help tremendously. The more of those we get, the more access other folks have to our show. So we really appreciate those just as much. Jamie, this has been an awesome week of research. I've enjoyed listening to some podcasts on the case we're going to talk about today. But, buddy, you have done the bulk of the research on this one, so please get us rolling.
Yeah, so we're going to cover a case that's really just come to light in the last month or so. It took place a couple years ago, and that's the case of Dr. Christopher Dunch, who was a neurosurgeon in Dallas, Texas, and he did a lot of bad stuff. We do all kinds of research to put into our episodes, but we also like to cite our sources when we have a major one. The Dr. Death podcast, produced by Wondery, provided a very comprehensive look at this case, so a lot of what we have came from there in addition to some reading, so if you want to hear some interviews with the individuals involved in this case, I encourage you to listen to Dr. Death. But what we're going to give you is a breakdown of the case, what happened, why, and where they are now. Starting with Dr. Christopher Dunch, he was a guy born in 1971 in Montana. His family moved to Memphis when he was in middle school, and he was raised there primarily through high school. He had a pretty standard upbringing. We don't think that he was the product of any kind of abuse. He seemed to have loving parents. His father was a physical therapist. His mom stayed at home. And although his dad was a physical therapist, which is great work and it's a good living, the Dunch family was still on the lower side of the income scale in their neighborhood. So in a lot of ways, Christopher Dunch felt like he was always battling uphill and trying to fight from behind. And because of that, he developed a work ethic that anybody throughout his life will tell you is absolute top-notch. He worked harder than anyone because he wanted to be the best at everything.
He became quite a football star. He was offered a scholarship to a small school in Mississippi, but he didn't really feel like that was good enough. So what he did was he tried out for a walk-on spot playing at Colorado State, which is a pretty well-known college football team. He made the team and worked just as hard at it as he did everything else in his life. His teammates would comment on his work ethic there. He would go through drills, and if he didn't get something right, he would stay after practice to run through it multiple times to aim for perfection. In 1991, he transferred after just 1 year in Colorado to a school in Memphis, but at that point there was no more football for him.
Since he didn't have football to focus on and he couldn't really focus his competitive fire in athletics, he decided to put all of his energy into preparing for medicine, John. Some of his roommates were a little surprised. They told stories about how he wasn't the most organized guy. There were a bunch of guys living in an apartment, and they said more often than you would assume would happen to a person, he would walk around the apartment asking where his keys were. Where are my keys? He would accuse everybody there. You stole my keys. You guys have hidden my keys. And every time that this happened, they would go and open the front door, and his keys would still be stuck in there. He was a hard worker. Everybody attests to that, but they just didn't think he was the brightest crayon in the box. So they were a little surprised that he wanted to do medicine. However, he graduated with honors from Memphis, and then he went on to the University of Tennessee's Health Science Center, and that's in 1995, to begin his medical school career. Once again there, he became a favorite of a lot of the faculty members. He was excellent in his research, and just like everyone else in his life, they noticed that he worked harder than all the other students at the medical school. He actually got connected, John, to some guys who were doing stem cell research to reproduce tissue, and he worked with a couple of researchers that developed a way to turn stem cells into disc replacements for spinal surgery. And he actually went in with those individuals, and they got a patent, and they started a business, and he really thought this was going to be his ticket to getting rich, was this stem cell laboratory. Despite his research, he did continue on to become a neurosurgeon. He did his residency in Memphis. And while he was there, John, I mean, a residency is essentially your first year as a doctor. So you do some shadowing, but you also do a lot of work yourself. And when folks first started looking into his background and what he actually did, it said that he actually participated in less than 100 surgeries on individual spine. Now, other doctors would tell you that anything less than 2,500 would be outlandish. The minimum number of surgeries or procedures you're going to be in is 2,500 to 3,000 during your residency. So it seems like somehow he was not prepared adequately at this residency.
I would like to go back and really find out how he was able to fall through the cracks that significantly. I mean, that's a very small number of surgeries that you've participated in when the number that you should have is 2,500. I mean, good grief. How did this guy just weasel his way out of all these?
It's not like he had 2,200 or 2,300. He had less than 100. So it's almost as if he didn't do any actual surgery during his residency. Maybe he was focused on the stem cell research and individuals just didn't notice that he was not in the operating room as much as he was supposed to be. But either way, this is unacceptable, both on his part and the part of the doctors overseeing this residency.
Yeah, and I think that's going to be kind of the running theme as we get into this case, is that there's just a lot of problems with the system, and we're going to certainly get into some of those. When he was finishing up his residency, he actually lived with one of his good friends that he played football with. His name was Jerry Summers. You're going to remember that name here in a few minutes, right, Jamie?
Oh, absolutely.
Jerry took care of Chris's day-to-day business operations. He bounced Chris's checkbook. He paid bills. He got insurance. He was actually a major part of the stem cell business. He was setting up and that business and doing advertisements for that business. So Jerry quickly became one of Chris's best friends and business partners, really. Chris was recruited to the Dallas area to practice neurosurgery. They paid a hefty signing bonus. Jamie, I think it was a $600,000 signing bonus. The particular job that I have does not have a signing bonus, but boy, that would be incredible.
I mean, yeah,
$600,000.
Just to sign to work with somebody. That's a field that maybe you and I should have considered.
Yeah, and while they paid that hefty bonus, they also put him up in a really nice hotel so he could settle down there and find a place to live. So he had a really nice place to stay in the meantime. He would begin practicing with Baylor University at the Plano campus, but of course he couldn't leave Jerry. So Jerry came with him, and he really helped Chris kind of run his life.
If you think back to the stories of him leaving the keys in the door, it seemed like he was just a very scattered individual that was always really focused on one thing but couldn't handle the other things. So Jerry was his guy that handled the other things. He was in a couple car accidents when he first got to Dallas, and Jerry took care of all those insurance claims and getting vehicles fixed and all those things, helped him set up his private practice. He did his procedures at Baylor University, but he had his own office where he would consult before those operations, and Jerry really got that set up for him. He also took his pregnant girlfriend, Wendy, to Dallas with him. She would be the mother of two of his kids. They set up the practice in Dallas, like you said, and local hospitals helped Chris to market himself. He kind of got off to a slow start. In his first few months, he got six surgeries or so, and I guess slow start is relative. I know anytime I've been in a hospital, especially with my parents, you see surgeons just coming and going. They're doing so many procedures every day. But when you're the patient, you think that your surgery is the one that's important and that they're focused on. But I would think six spinal surgeries in a few months would be a lot for somebody to prepare for and execute. But it was really kind of slow, relatively. So things were slow, and he went to Jerry with an interesting proposal, John. Jerry had a football injury from high school in his neck, and it really wasn't that bad until a few years later when he had a car accident that kind of compounded the injury, and it wasn't debilitating in any way. He just kind of lived with pain all the time, and I think a lot of people who have been involved in football or other athletics can identify with that. So Chris offered to fix this problem. He said, Jerry, things are going slow at the business. I've got time to do this operation. You have insurance, so it'll pay for most of it. Let's get your neck fixed. There's no reason not to at this point. Now, John, if I was a surgeon and I offered to do surgery on you, even if you fully trusted me, what would your reaction be? Be honest.
I mean, there's a part of me that would be a little skeptical because that is a major thing to happen. But at the same time, you're a trained neurosurgeon. This is what you went to college for. This is what you went to residency for. So you should be fully prepared because of all the people around you in your life who made sure that you were prepared to do this. So I think I would be hesitant for anyone to do this operation, but for my best friend, you know, it's a little weird, but I'd probably trust you because you're trained medically to do so.
Yeah, I guess it's kind of a two-sided coin for me. I could see the avenue of you're my friend. You more than anybody else is going to have my best interest in mind. You're going to fight harder for me. You're going to do absolutely everything. But I think I would also want somebody that wasn't emotionally tied to me, somebody that's doing their training, doing their best, but they're not going to make decisions based on emotion. So, I don't know, if you want to operate on my foot or, I don't know, lance something off my skin, that's one thing. But messing with somebody's spine is some serious stuff.
I mean, and Jerry has seen all these other behaviors in his life. He's seen him do some stupid stuff as far as leaving his keys in a door. And that's not just a one-time thing. I mean, we wouldn't be on a guy's back for that. This happened multiple times. He's seen Chris do some weird stuff, but he's willing to put literally his life in this guy's hands. So, I don't know.
Yeah, well, this did not work out great for Jerry, John. The point of the surgery was to go in and to repair a disc. He was supposed to take some bone off of it and fill it with some gel foam that would stabilize that part of his neck. But when he went in, he removed way too much bone, and he put way too much gel foam into Jerry's neck. Jerry woke up the next morning, and he couldn't move. Chris went back to do another surgery to alleviate the pressure because of all the foam in there. It created a lot of pressure within the spine, and he did that. But Jerry still could not move anything below his neck. When other doctors would take a look at this, tests actually showed John that Jerry's head was no longer attached at his spine. Essentially, he had decapitated his best friend in this surgery that was just meant to alleviate pain. Jerry's now quadriplegic. Again, he cannot move anything besides his head. And as far as we know, there was no immediate remorse. Jerry was calm in the beginning in his reaction to the surgery. Chris kept telling Jerry and his girlfriend Jenny that everything was going to be okay and just to give it a week for the pressure to subside and he would be okay. But as time kept ticking on, they started to see that this was not going to reverse itself. Could you imagine doing that to somebody that you cared deeply about, even if it was an accident, and how much that would weigh on you?
I mean, Jamie, knowing my personality, it would honestly eat me alive. You know, not only for the fact that this happened, and I would just feel extremely awful that it happened, but with his training as a neurosurgeon, he had to know that the long-term prognosis of him after this surgery was not going to be okay. But instead of being honest and showing remorse and telling Jerry and his family the truth, in my mind, he kind of hid that fact, offered him false hope, and that's equally as bad in my mind.
I agree. And, you know, complications happen. Accidents will happen. Surgeons are humans like us. They're going to make accidents. That's why they have insurance for malpractice or whatever. But for it to be his best friend and for it to be so extreme, you go from, I'm just going to take your pain away, not you can't walk, let me fix it, but I'm going to take away your discomfort and now you're quadriplegic. It's unfathomable to me.
You asked me earlier what would I would feel like if you offered to do surgery on me. Thinking about that a little bit more, I don't think I would do surgery on my best friend because, like you said, accidents do happen, and I wouldn't want that on my hands if something went bad. You know, I think that could definitely make Thanksgiving dinners a lot more awkward, knowing that I've hurt you, and, you know, that's just not a situation I would want to put myself in. So I don't think I would even consider doing a surgery on my best friend, but I don't have to worry about that because I'm not a surgeon.
Yeah, I think I would make a very strong referral to another surgeon that I trusted, but I would stay away from that on my own.
This was one of the many operations that Chris botched in his career. Before he was caught, he operated on a total of 38 patients, and Jamie, 33 of those patients experienced extreme complications or death. Now, how does somebody get through so many faulty surgeries without getting their license completely revoked?
That's 87% of his surgeries went wrong.
Thanks for the math there.
I got my calculator out while you were talking.
I just assumed you were texting someone, but yeah, thanks for the math. So 87% of his surgeries went wrong. So honestly, Jamie, how do you not get your license revoked?
There has to be something wrong with the system, and that's kind of where we're going to end up going here. But there were complaints to the hospital. They knew that he was doing something wrong, and we're going to get into some specific complaints here in a few moments. But if the hospital lets him go, then they're risking being sued by the doctor for ruining and slandering their name. And they're risking bringing more light to their problems and bringing on more lawsuits. So honestly, I think a lot of this is going to boil down to money, but no hospital would step in because they didn't want to put their own name and their own money on the line.
Another example of his malpractice happened on March 12, 2012. That is when 55-year-old Kelly Martin came in for a quote, unquote, simple procedure. This was supposed to be a 45-minute operation, and Jamie, it's reported that this actually lasted several hours. During the procedure, Christopher accidentally sliced an artery in Miss Kelly, but he didn't recognize it right away. So what ended up happening was she ended up passing away because she essentially bled to death. If he would have recognized his mistake sooner in the operation, I think it, you know, could have probably been fixed. But it almost seemed like he just wasn't trained to recognize some of these simple things. And I say simple because it is, you know, brain surgery or neurosurgery. So some of these things, though, that would have been routine for other surgeons, he just wasn't able to recognize those things. And it cost Kelly Martin her life that day. That was really the last straw there at the Baylor Plano campus. He was released from Baylor Plano in March of 2012 due to the botched operations, but they released him with a clean record. Jamie, you know, I'm just baffled as to why they would do that. I mean, they are putting other patients at risk by not reporting his issues to the board or to his next employer. They could have reported them to the state board. This is the board that maintains licenses, so if there's ever a complaint against a surgeon, you can report it to the board. They're equipped to investigate these cases. They could have simply investigated them. They could have saw his 87% malpractice rate and known that there was an issue. But Baylor Plano did not report any of these to the state board. There's also a registry of malpractice where hospitals can access complaints about physicians. So if I'm a hospital administrator and I want to hire Jamie as a neurosurgeon, I can get on this registry and see what complaints have come in about him. They didn't report him to that either. They just got him off their hands. They just simply let him go and wished him well, basically. So it baffles me as to why they wouldn't make at least one of these reports to these agencies.
That registry would be a national registry, too, and some believe that that's why they didn't do it, that it would be a big deal for him to get another job, so they feared that he would bring a lawsuit against them for smearing his name and not allowing him to get another job. So, again, they're afraid of losing money and ruining their own name, so they just want him out of their building.
Let's fast forward to the cases that were really the beginning of the end for Mr. Dunch. At this point, in July of 2012, he is operating in Dallas Medical Center. On July 24th, he performs an operation on a 63-year-old lady named Floella Brown. Now, she had had a brainstem stroke. He went in to operate, and it seemed to have really no idea what he was doing. Reports showed that he removed bone he had no business removing. The bigger problem was that he inserted a screw into an artery. Blood was getting into her brain, and she quickly slipped into a coma the next morning.
He sliced an artery earlier, and that's what happened to Kelly Martin. And now he's inserted a screw into an artery. So we're seeing that he really doesn't have an understanding of the way blood flows through the body, of cardiovascular systems, and how that intertwines with the spine. Even if he had been doing his other surgeries correctly, he's obviously messing up with the arteries. The next day, Floella Brown was sitting in ICU. She was in a coma, and he went ahead and started another operation they had scheduled with Mary Eford. Surgery was supposed to begin at 7, John, and he rolled into the hospital about 7:45. I know that hospitals get behind on procedures. I know that people can be running late. But there were some other concerns that morning about Christopher Dunch. The OR staff had wondered, just based on looking at him, if he was on something. For example, looking at his eyes, they worried if he was high in some way. And they also noticed that he had a hole in the seat of his scrubs. They pointed out that he did not wear underpants, so they saw through the hole to his bare bottom. Which is a concern of itself, but they also recalled that they had seen that same hole the day before when he was operating on Floella Brown, and the same hole the day before that. So 3 days in a row, he'd worn the same exact scrubs into surgery, which is not okay. He is not living a lifestyle of a surgeon, and the OR staff started to recognize these things. 74-year-old Mary Eford was there to get a disc repaired. And halfway through the operation, Chris starts complaining that he can't see. He says, "There's so much blood, I can't see what I'm doing." And they're operating the suction. They're trying to clear it out so that he can see, but he's just getting frustrated. And you can also tell he's frustrated because he's aware of what is happening with Floella Brown in the ICU. He wants to go in and do a craniotomy to relieve the pressure on her brain, because of the mistakes that he had made the day before. However, their hospital has a policy against that procedure and does not have the proper equipment. So he says, "I'm the doctor, we're doing this." The OR staff says, "We're not equipped for it." And he starts making demands and yelling at people. So he's trying to leave Mary Eford on the table and then go and repair an operation from the day before. And, John, leaving somebody open like that, the longer that somebody is open during surgery, the greater risk there is for a whole host of problems to happen. So leaving somebody open on a table while you're going to make other decisions is just not at all okay. While he's gone, The surgical staff is looking into Mary Eifert, and they actually find a screw that's attached to a muscle. They can tell in the x-ray that it's nowhere near any kind of bone. When Dunch gets back to the OR, they point it out, but he insisted, that screw is exactly where I need it to be. It's in the bone, I assure you. I put it in myself. He eventually wraps up this operation, and when Eifert wakes up the next day, she's in excruciating pain, and she can't move her legs. Now, that same day, Floella Brown passes away before she could be transferred to another hospital for the craniotomy. So in this two-day span, July 24th and 25th of 2012, he has two huge, very public mistakes at Dallas Medical Center. Now, at this point, John, what do we think is causing this? Do you think that, and maybe this is a bigger discussion for the end, is he doing this on purpose, or is he just incredibly incompetent?
Yeah, I think as I'm listening to this case and reflecting on it, I don't think that he's being malicious. I think he's just a really bad surgeon. And I say that, I mean, we already know this guy has not had adequate training, so this really shouldn't come as a surprise. He's able to do these major operations without significant, you know, prior experience.
Yeah, it's so hard to tell because he's very defensive about his mistakes. He doesn't seem to care that he's causing these big problems, even to his very best friend who he removed his head. And at some point he has to, I don't know, where's the empathy here? Where's the recognition of, I need to improve, I need to do better, I need help? Even if he's not causing the damage on purpose, this looks really shady, and we're definitely going to get into that. This isn't true malpractice cast. This is true crime cast. So we're going to get into the criminal part in just a little bit.
The hospital administration realized they need to call somebody in for support at this time. That's when they called in Dr. Robert Henderson to come in and kind of do an assessment and help out. When Dr. Henderson came in and looked at the plan that Christopher had outlined, he noticed that it was, on paper at least, a perfect procedure. It was planned out perfectly. However, when he opened up Mary to find out what had happened, he noticed numerous problems. He actually noticed so many that he decided this is going to end up in a lawsuit and we need to be prepared to outline everything that happened. So what he did was he created a video and dictated on the video exactly what he had saw and what he was doing to fix this problem. And Jamie, there are a few things that he noticed and saw that was in the video, and I want to outline those. First, you mentioned it, there was a screw tightened into soft tissue material. So instead of a screw being inserted into the bone, essentially Christopher had screwed in the screw into this poor lady's muscle.
Ugh.
He also noticed that there were rods that were inserted that weren't even attached to screws. So these are just kind of in the wrong place. They're not doing anything at this point. They're in her body but not being structural. There's a spinal cage that they were going to put around this vertebrae, I guess. I feel like I'm saying words that I don't really understand.
It was to stabilize the spinal cord.
But it was put in the wrong place. And if that wasn't enough, what he noticed was that he wasn't even working on the correct spot. He was working on a different spot entirely than what she was needing. And he also removed a nerve root, which is the reason why she couldn't feel her legs.
Dr. Henderson did what he could to repair these mistakes, but Mary Eifert was never the same. She could walk again eventually, but she still just had so much pain in her legs, and there's nothing they can do to repair the damage caused by Dr. Dunch. This is just unfathomable that he could go in and do all this damage and assume that he did a good job. Dr. Henderson was so concerned about all this, he was able to connect to another doctor, a guy named Dr. Randall Kirby, who is a vascular surgeon that has had his own problems with Dr. Dunch. Kirby had assisted on the surgery of Barry Morgeloff 3 weeks before Jerry Summers' surgery. And in that procedure, Dr. Dunch was supposed to perform a spinal fusion, which is an incredibly routine procedure for a neurosurgeon. But he removed instead of removing the disc, he was supposed to use a scalpel to make cuts on either side of the disc to remove it. Instead, he used a pair of pliers and just grabbed it and started pulling on it. So he was not following adequate procedure. Dr. Kirby actually at one point stopped him and said, just let me do this. You're not doing it right. So with those pliers, he caused a lot of damage to the surrounding discs and vertebrae. And Dr. Kirby was furious watching this. So when Henderson and Kirby finally connected with one another, they went straight to the state medical board, which you referenced earlier. As it turned out, though, Dallas Medical Center was making the same claims to the state board of malpractice for Dr. Dunch. The medical board has the ability to suspend his license, John, but they're always really hesitant to do that immediately. They don't want to stop somebody from making income for claims that could end up being false. They don't want to kick somebody out of being out of their practice and end up being sued later for causing them to miss out on work. So the state board's policy is to do a thorough investigation before making any decisions. Now, you can see the problem for that, John, is that they're doing this investigation while this person is continuing to practice. Now, with most malpractice issues, it is an accident, and it's not repeated as they investigate. But for Christopher Dunch, unfortunately, he repeated it quite a bit. He was released from Dallas Medical and ended up finding a new home at Southampton Hospital. That was a very old hospital, John, in a very poverty-stricken part of Dallas. And it said that when some individuals would go to the hospital or found out he was operating there, they were very put off by that because that's not, when you're paying for spinal surgery, you don't expect to do it in such an old facility in such a bad part of town. But why did these hospitals, even such a low-income hospital, in such a poor area, why did they keep giving this man a job since he'd been fired twice?
Let me answer your question with a question. How many neurosurgeons do you know?
That number is somewhere between none and zero.
Well, the same is true for me. There's just not very many of these guys out there. And at the same time, when a hospital can hire a neurosurgeon, it's estimated that those hospitals gain an additional $2 million in revenue. So we got to remember, hospitals are businesses. And if they can hire somebody on staff that brings in an additional $2 million in revenue, that's a good hire. And like I said before, the point I was trying to make is there are not very many of them. There's not a lot of competition for these jobs. It's not like what you and I do. They could fire us and get a new person in tomorrow. But for a neurosurgeon, it's much different.
Gee, I hope our bosses don't listen to this.
Nobody listens to this.
Touche. Touche.
So honestly, as long as he's able to maintain his license, he's going to be employed by somebody because these hospitals see these guys as just walking money bags, basically.
Which means he's going to continue operating on people.
Unfortunately, yes. Yeah. So he's at Southampton, and honestly, the bad streak continued. Let's talk about Shirley Mock. She was not happy about having to have her operation at Southampton, as you said. I remember hearing one of the interviews, and it may have been Shirley's husband. If not, it was somebody else. But he said that when he got to this hospital, it looked like it should have been condemned 20 years before. So this is kind of a rundown hospital in a very poor neighborhood, and yet we're having neurosurgery performed there.
Right.
So kind of crazy. But her surgery actually went pretty well compared to Jerry's and all the other ones we've already talked about.
Or at least it seemed.
Right. So at her follow-up, she had to have x-rays just to see how things went. And that's when the x-ray showed shards of bone and metal that were left behind. Now, he sees this, and what does he do? He actually says, you must have fallen. This wasn't part of my procedure. I didn't do this. This was something that happened because you've fallen. She's like, no, I haven't fallen. This is not something that I did. So he actually has to take her back in, open her up again to repair the things that he messed up the first time. Fortunately, these accidents, this mistake, didn't cost her her life or her well-being. She just had to go in and fix his screw-ups again.
Yeah, it cost her more pain, more complications. And shards is a word I hope we wouldn't have to use when talking about spinal surgery. John, now we're going to jump into his final operation. This was in May of 2013 on a guy named Jerry Glidewell. This was another common procedure called a cervical fusion. Again, if he had done 3,000 of these in his residency, maybe this wouldn't have been a problem. When he got in to do the procedure, though, near the top of Jerry's spine, he saw a mass, which he thought might be some kind of cancer, some kind of growth, so he lanced it to, in case he needed to do a biopsy. When Glidewell woke up, he had a couple problems. There was a lot of pain in his neck, and he couldn't talk, which is super suspect. Why on earth could somebody not talk after a back surgery? But as it turns out, that mass that had been cut, John, was just Jerry Glidewell's neck muscle. He just cut a chunk of the muscle out because he didn't know what it was. And we had talked about how in a couple different operations, he'd either inadvertently sliced an artery, put a screw into an artery. He had also cut Jerry Glidewell's vocal cords, so he couldn't talk. Dunch sewed him back up and left a sponge that was meant to soak up blood inside of Jerry's spinal column. So when Jerry woke up, he couldn't talk because he had been his vocal cords had been cut. He had a sponge in his spine, creating a lot of pressure, and he had had part of his neck muscle cut off. Like, so many things had gone wrong. I had mentioned Dr. Randall Kirby earlier. He happened to be involved with that hospital in some way, and he found out about this operation, John, and he was livid. He wrote a very strongly worded letter to the medical board, and they finally, after so many complaints about Christopher Dunch, suspended his license. Dr. Kirby also wrote a sworn statement in June of 2013 outlining the wrongdoings in every case that he was aware of. He called Dunch a sociopath and called for his medical license to be fully revoked, not just suspended. And Dr. Henderson went on record to say that the suspension always scared everyone because suspensions can be overturned immediately and he could have been back in the operating room the next day. So they really wanted this license to be revoked. In December of that year, they did revoke his license, finally. And they admit that he did not, and this is the big catch-all term that these licensure boards and hospitals use, he did not meet the standard of care for at least six patients. Standard of care, John, to go in and cut somebody's vocal cords, to put a screw in their artery, to decapitate your best friend. He did not meet the standard of care. So we've mentioned that it's hard to tell whether he was doing this on purpose. It really doesn't seem that way at the time. So why is there no empathy? Why is there no remorse? Why is there no course correction, John? Do you think that he is, as Dr. Kirby called him, a sociopath?
We have some evidence of that, Jamie. So let's talk about some of those pieces of evidence that would make one believe that he could, in fact, be a sociopath. He had a secretary in 2011 that he was also having an affair with. And we have a pretty interesting email. Now, when I heard this email, I didn't know what to think of it. So let's read a little bit of it, talk about it for a second.
Absolutely.
So in this email, he wrote, "You, my child, are the only thing between me and the other side. I'm ready to leave the love and kindness and goodness and patience that I mix with everything else that I am and become a cold-blooded killer." So when I heard that, I thought, okay, is this guy like drunk or high or both? What is he talking about? And what's the matter with this guy?
Yeah, no, it's mind-blowing that he actually said, "I'm going to become a cold-blooded killer," as a surgeon. And then, whether it's related or not, ends up killing people and severely injuring people. It's just mind-blowing.
He also wrote a sentence in an email that I don't know what to do with. He wrote, "I am one of a kind, a stone-cold killer that can buy or own or steal or ruin or build whatever he wants." So he sees himself in a very interesting way. Certainly. So
yeah, obviously there's some narcissism there, maybe a bit of God complex type thing. John, do you remember when that email was sent?
Jamie, this was sent exactly 1 month before he operated on his best friend Jerry Summers and decapitated him.
So a month before, and this is shortly into his career, right? Jerry was his seventh surgery. A month before he does this to his friend, and he writes this email saying that he's going to be a cold-blooded killer and that he is really all about the power that he has in these operations. It's just awful, and it's super frustrating that nobody reported these things sooner. Of course, she was having an affair with him, and I don't know when that ended, but if she would have said something to somebody, that could have saved a life. That could have saved somebody's lifestyle or quality of life, at least. It's almost unbelievable, John, to me, that he was able to practice as long as he was. Now, again, we've talked about how surgeries go wrong, surgeons make mistakes. Does any of this classify as criminal?
Well, Jamie, in the course of history, it certainly hadn't before. Prosecutors would say that they had never heard of another case where a doctor was charged for actions committed as part of their jobs. You know, this is often referred to as malpractice lawsuits, but nobody's tried criminally there. It's just a civil action where somebody was hurt. It took some time to build a case, but finally the district attorney found enough evidence that charges would be brought and they would stick. He was arrested in July of 2015 and charged with 5 felony counts of aggravated assault causing serious bodily injury, 1 count of injury to a child, elderly, or disabled person, and that was from the botched surgery of Mary Aford. Between his license being revoked and him getting charged with these crimes, he really hit rock bottom, Jamie, when he was hit with shoplifting and intoxication arrests. So, Jamie, what happened there?
Yeah, he actually went into a department store and tried to steal some pants. And he was also pulled over visiting someone in Colorado and arrested for driving while intoxicated. So you can hear, I mentioned the Dr. Death podcast, some interviews and some conversations between Dunch and his father where you can tell that he's just kind of done. He's in a really bad place when all this is happening.
Now, Jamie, why is the timing so important for the arrest that happened in July of 2015 regarding the charge of the injury to an elderly person?
Like you mentioned, this was going to be an unprecedented charge to put somebody in a criminal courtroom for something that they had done in the operating room. So they really wanted to find a charge that would stick, that they had evidence for, but also one that would give the jury and judge some leeway in sentencing. So the count of an injury to a child, elderly, or disabled person actually carries a sentence of up to 99 years because it was of an elderly individual, that being 74-year-old Mary Aford. So them building the case around Mary Aford was what made them more comfortable going into the courtroom because they felt like he was definitely a danger to people. He had injured 33 of the 38 people. He had killed at least 2 of his patients, and they wanted him to pay for that. So they found this charge, and they had to build up the evidence to support it so that he could go away for that long. And as it turns out, that was actually the only charge that he was found guilty on. So if they had just gone to trial with the felony counts of aggravated assault, he may have gotten his license back. He may still be operating.
I remember that they also had to do this rather quickly because there are statute of limitations on this particular crime, and they were approaching the end of that statute of limitations when they were bringing charges up against them. So they had to move pretty quickly to get this conviction.
They were rushing. They had just a few months left on that statute. He was found guilty on February 20th, 2017, of causing injury to an elderly person. He was sentenced to life in prison. He's eligible for parole in 2045. At that time, he will be 74 years old. Again, 38 operations, 33 individuals that were injured or worse. At least 2 of them died as a direct result of the operation. All hospitals, all 4 hospitals that he operated at, John, are currently still in litigation. They're being sued for his actions, essentially. The hospitals are being held accountable in civil cases, like you mentioned. He's currently appealing the verdict, but if that's successful, the prosecutors say that they're more than willing to go back to court, and if they do that, they're going to add more charges for other victims of what he had been doing. So, I mean, here are the questions. How does the medical system allow this to happen? Is money that big of a deal that they're going to let people be killed and paralyzed on an operating table so they don't get sued?
You're asking me that question, and man, I just have no answer, man. I can't believe that Christopher has been allowed to practice this long, and there's not a good reason. If you suspect somebody has been hurt at the hands of a physician, it has to be reported, and I don't think there's any excuses. There's no reason as to why that would be acceptable. So these hospitals, you know, when I listen to this case, yes, he should be punished. But I also think that everybody that had a hand in not allowing this to be investigated and not allowing this to be turned in, I think they should be responsible as well. I think it's ridiculous that there are these practices in place that would allow for such a gross misconduct to happen.
For anybody that turned a blind eye or ignored a complaint, or the hospitals that passed him off to another hospital, I agree, they're just as responsible for what happened after they made that decision as Christopher Dunch is. And it's just so unbelievable. Legally speaking, does this set a new precedent for the way that physicians are able to be held accountable for their actions in their practice?
I think it's pretty interesting that we have a criminal case here and not just a civil matter that would pay out money. But I think that this should have been the case all along. If you have a physician who's impaired or operates while intoxicated, that's more than, in my mind, just a civil case. That is a criminal offense. So I think it's pretty interesting here that this could actually set a new precedent, like you said, of bringing criminal charges to these physicians instead of just a hefty lawsuit that their insurance is going to pay, and it's not going to affect them anyway.
It certainly could, and I think we're going to have to wait and see if that translates to other professions as well that have been immune to the criminal charges. Even in my field of working in education, there are insurances I can have where if I get sued for malpractice in some way or advising a student in the wrong way, that the insurance will cover that. But again, that's a civil suit, so you have to wonder if this is going to be opened up to psychiatrists and counselors and social workers and things like that. It's going to be interesting to see that moving forward. And the big question we always ask, John, has justice been served here?
Well, he was sentenced to life in prison. You know, I just think about the people that he didn't kill. You know, I know that Jerry, I can't help but put myself in Jerry's shoes and not wish that I wasn't dead. I mean, he is went from this guy who was living a pretty normal life to now he's a quadriplegic. He has hurt so many people. You know, how do you get justice for that? How do you can't repair these people that have been so broken. You know, but justice, you know, he's going to be in jail for a long time and he deserves it. But I mean, how do you get justice for people who have been hurt so bad at this guy's hands?
For as much as it exists within our legal system, I do think that justice was served with the life sentence. He's eligible for parole in 2045, but that certainly does not mean that he will be paroled. But I agree with you. There is no actual justice that exists here, but given the limitations of our legal system, I think this is as close as we're ever going to get for a case like this. And this is something that I think most people were unaware of before a month ago when the Dr. Death podcast debuted, and it's just fascinating.
Something interesting that I learned in the course of this research was just that there are caps for attorneys who are filing malpractice lawsuits. We both have a dear friend who had a heart attack, and doctors had to remove a vein from his arm, and they completely botched that surgery. He is going to have limited mobility of his arm for the rest of his life. And if you were to see his arm, you would see that they had to put in, I think it was like 200 staples, and the scar that he has on his arm looks awful. He cannot find an attorney to represent him because there are caps on how many lawsuits you can have annually for malpractice lawsuits. So even though the doctors were totally at fault for this guy's arm being messed up, there's nothing he can do about it. He can't do anything about it in court. And I think it's just another product of how broken our medical system is right now. So in his case, he can't get justice because our court systems will not allow for it.
The hope is that this Christopher Dunch case will just create conversations about those things. How do we legislate medical practice and medical malpractice? And hopefully some of those things will be changed. I'm hopeful.
Yeah. I think it's interesting to learn more about it, and I think this was a very interesting case. So, man, thanks for bringing it our way. Guys, please check us out on Facebook, Twitter. If you have a case suggestion you would like to get to us, please do so by shooting us an email at truecrimecast@gmail.com. As Jamie mentioned before, please check out our Patreon. That's growing pretty quickly, and we'd love to have you come on board. Guys, until next crime, this has been True Crime Cast.